We broke off somewhat in the middle of a story yesterday. Abraham was concerned with finding a wife for his son Isaac, and he wanted it to be a wife of his people, and we would presume of the same religion or at least somewhat towards that. So remember, he sent a servant. Servant's not named. It might have been the earlier named Eleazar of Damascus, or possibly not. But remember, he makes the servant take an oath with that enigmatic phrase, "Put your hand under my thigh," whatever that means. And he says, if the woman is not willing to come back here, you're free of the oath. The servant takes 10 camel loads of Abraham's stuff, a lot of riches, and we presume other servants to help. Shows up, you know, near Haran, goes to the well, and makes a fervent prayer to God. God, please, you know, I'm trying to find this woman. I'm paraphrasing, but it says, let the woman who's designed to be the wife for Isaac be the one that, when I ask her if she'll give me a drink of her water, she on her own offers to draw water for all the camels as well. Which is kind of a smart idea in a way. When you want God to show you something, you know, he's often not going to say, tap you on the shoulder, say, that's the one, you know, or put a neon sign over her. And you don't want to rely on just your own feelings. Oh, I think she looks good. She must be the one. I'm sure God is showing me. He asked God to have her do something very unusual. And I mentioned 10 camels worth of water is a lot of water. And surprisingly to the servant, the very first woman he asked, he didn't have to go through several. He sees the woman who turns out to be Rebecca, who is Abraham's niece, I believe great niece. And we're in chapter 24, by the way. I'm summarizing to get up to where we left off. In verse 17, he ran and said, please let me have a drink of water. She says, drink, my lord. And quickly she put her hand down to give her a drink. When she'd finished, she said, I'll draw water for your camels also till they've finished drinking. She went quickly and, you know, drew water. Verse 21 says, the man wondering at her remained silent. I always interpret that as the guy was amazed. It's like, man, I prayed this prayer and the very first shot out of the box, it happens. So he's like, amazed. You ever do that? You ask God for something and he answers your prayer and you're, oh, wow, he actually did it. That's terrific. And so, of course, then he takes the step of getting out some gold and to give her. And so he gives her the golden nose ring, the golden bracelets, and says, whose daughter are you? Is there room in your father's house? She says who she is, whose daughter she is. I'm the daughter of Bethuel, Milcah's son, whom she bore to Nahor. Moreover, you know, we have straw and feed enough to lodge in. Man bowed his head and worshiped God. Again, we see that he's not just doing this stuff because of this weird religion of his master. He worships God. He's on board. He believes these things. He says, blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth to my master. As for me, okay, God hasn't forsaken Abraham, but as for me, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren. He's very happy about this, and appropriately so. So the young woman went and told her mother's household these things. Interesting, we'll note this, her mother's household. Rebecca had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out to meet the man. This is our first meeting of Laban, and one of the first things we notice about him is that when it comes to Pat, he saw the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist. Laban notices the riches. We're going to see as we follow, you know, we'll spend some time with Laban later, that Laban seems to be motivated by money. It's not wrong to be at least have some motivation by money, but Laban perhaps more than others. Yes, Sky?
When he said he put the nose ring on her, did he have to pierce her nose already, or would it have already been pierced?
Well, it doesn't really say. So him piercing her nose might have been kind of extreme. So it's more likely it was something that kind of clips in. So it might have been a different style than is common today. So I'll mention the thing I was going to comment on that later on in Practical Christianity we'll talk about. Fashion and things like that. And there was a time when nose rings weren't common in society, and the church might have taught against them, but we had to say, well, it's in the Bible. You can't say this is wrong or this is evil when it's there. You know, Emily?
Just out of curiosity, do you think that the dad is dead then? Just since he's dealing with the brother
now? I was going to comment on that. Now, we'll see a Bethuel mentioned. But as you go through the story, let me just comment on it here, because many scholars think that Bethuel the father of Rebecca and Laban probably is dead. Because we'll see Laban taking the lead. I mentioned going to her mother's household. There's a Bethuel mentioned. If we'd see in verse, I had it here somewhere because I've got this note to mention it. We'll get to it. There's a Bethuel mentioned that a lot of scholars think might have been Laban's younger brother. That he's there, but it's not Bethuel, the leader of the household. And as I said, because Laban is taking the lead, you see a lot of things where the father of the household isn't even mentioned. So some have speculated, well, maybe he was just senile. He had early onset Alzheimer's or something, but it's more likely that he just wasn't around at this time. That's not a certainty, and it doesn't change much. It's just, you know, a curious thing that comes up. So we see this, we go through this, skipping ahead, of course. They bring the man to the household, they unload the camels, they wash his feet, food is set, so they take care of the camels, get them something to eat. But he says, matter of fact, let's read in verse 33. Food was set before him, but he said, I will not eat until I've told about my errand. So it's like, I got to take care of business first. I can't relax. This is weighing on me. And so he says, I'm Abraham's servant. Now, who's Abraham? Well, apparently they know, or he'll explain it, but it's not mentioned. But, you know, he was Bethuel was Abraham's brother, so they've got this relation going on. And the Lord has blessed my master greatly. He's become great. He's given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male and female servants. So Abraham's doing great while he's over there in the promised land. And he said, my master made me swear, don't take a wife for my son from the daughters of Canaan. Go to my father's house and to my family, and there take a wife for my son. So he said, okay, you know. Basically, the servant describes everything we've already read, so I'm not going to read it again, even though I skimmed across it. That's one of the reasons this is one of the longer chapters we come across. You see 67 verses, but it tells us the same story a couple of times. And I wanted to get to, well, he describes how he came across Rebekah, the miracle he'd asked God for. It's verse 50 where it says, then Laban and Bethuel answered. Again, we think this probably is not Bethuel the father. It would have probably said Bethuel and Laban answered. And we don't hear much about Bethuel after that. But it says, the thing comes from the Lord. We can't speak to you either bad or good. This indicates that they are worshiping this God to some degree. They certainly seem to accept that God answered his prayer and there was a miracle. But later we'll have some question. We'll see later on that we know Laban is also having some household idols. So they're not worshiping God quite the way Abraham is, but they seem to have some respect at least. So basically, in verse 51, they say, here's Rebekah before you, take her and go. Let her be your master's son's wife. Guys, don't you wish it was that easy? You say a prayer, ask for a miracle, the woman you're supposed to be married to shows up, and the family says, take her and go. Doesn't usually work that way. Girls, you might wish it was that easy too. A very wealthy guy shows up and says, I've got the marriage meant in heaven for you. Well, I don't want to make this about matchmaking, but as I said, it's not usually that easy. Verse 52, when it came to pass, when Abraham's servant heard these words, he worshiped the Lord, bowing himself to the earth. So it seems like he gets up from the table, he's really pleased. Talk about blessings from God. And he's worshiping God. Then he breaks out the real riches. He brought out jewelry of silver, jewelry of gold, and clothing, gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. Here again, there's a phrase that makes us think the father is not around because he gives precious things to the brother and mother. This seems to be describing the payment of what is called a dowry, or you'll see the term bride price. And in that culture, it was common the family of the groom would pay the family of the bride's, pay the bride's family a certain amount of money. So they make this agreement. Again, all that's happening. Verse 54, he and the men who were there with him ate and drank, stayed all night. So they have a big celebration, a big meal. He's an early riser. He gets up in the morning and says, let's go. Send me away to my master. And the family's like, whoa, you're leaving now? You know, the brother and her mother, again, no father, said, well, let the young woman stay with us a few days, at least 10, you know, and then she may go. Okay, so they're just not eager to have her leave quite so soon. But he says, you know, don't hinder me, since the eternal is haven't even had any coffee since a while ago. Since the eternal has prospered my way, let me go to my master. So he wants to do it, and they say, well, let's call the young woman. Let's ask Rebecca what she wants to do. And it's not asking, do you want to go or not? It's, do you want to go today, or do you want to wait a little while and get your affairs in order? So they give her the choice. Hey, this guy says, let's go right now. We want him to wait a couple weeks. Rebecca's on board. She said, I will go. So they sent away Rebecca, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant. Well, having a servant to send with her shows that they weren't exactly poor people either. And they blessed Rebecca. Verse 60, we don't know if this is necessarily inspired prophecy, but it does match with some of the promises that God had made to Abraham and would to Isaac. Our sister, may you become the mother of thousands of 10,000s. Does that come out to millions? 10 million? So that's a lot. And it doesn't mean her personally become the mother of all those. Obviously, that would be ridiculous. May your descendants possess the gates of those who hate them. And we've talked about the gates of their enemies, the sea gates that the English-speaking peoples would eventually control. So, of course, they load Rebecca and her maids, now it says, rather than just one. So maybe she took a little bit of a retinue. They rode on camels and followed the man. The servant took Rebecca and departed. Now, Isaac came from the way of Beer Lahairoi, boy, and I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, for he dwelt in the south, and Isaac went out to meditate. Now, this isn't all that important, but it's interesting. Isaac had come from someplace else, and he came up. There's some speculation that Isaac had moved away from Abraham and had his own household at this point, but was back visiting or back waiting to see what the servant's going to come up with. Don't take that as a certainty, but it seems perhaps a possibility. Of course, he went out to meditate in the field. We were just talking about meditating yesterday. That's a good way to do that. He's not out with his legs cross-legged and, you know, looking at his navel, but he's out thinking. He lifts up his eyes, and look, the camels are coming. From the other direction, this is like towards the end of a great movie, you know. He looks, and here come the camels. And then you see her, she looks, and there's some guy out there. She asks the servant, you know, who is this? Who is this man walking the field towards? The servant said, it's my master. So she took a veil and covered herself. It's worth mentioning, this doesn't seem to be referring to a veil such as is common in Islamic practice today, where the women are always covered in public. It might be referring to proper dress for a wedding or for someone who's about to be married to someone. And I just wanted to point that out because some people would make that connection, but it's an anachronistic connection. You know, Islam didn't exist, and that practice of women wearing a hijab or whatever probably wasn't around. But for whatever the reason exactly, she wanted to cover herself. Yes, Jan?
Also, she had been with a servant all the time, so that wouldn't have made any sense.
Exactly, yeah. So, but she does this getting ready for the wedding, it seems. Verse 66, the servant told Isaac all the things that he'd done. And thankfully, they don't tell us the story yet again. But it says, Isaac brought her to his mother Sarah's tent and took Rebecca. She became his wife, and he loved her. Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Okay, it doesn't say it here, but the next chapter, in chapter 25, verse 20, will tell us that Isaac was 40 years old at this time. So 40 years old seems to be an age to get married in this family, at least for some of them. How old was Rebecca? We have no idea. Doesn't tell us. So I doubt that she was 40, but it's possible. But Isaac was 40. We don't know. So there's several things we don't know about this. Here we see it says that they consummated the marriage. He took her to Sarah's tent, and we know what happened there. The reason I would want to point it out, though, something interesting. The Bible, not only not here, but nowhere, gives us a formal ceremony for marriage. There just isn't one where it says, okay, they should do this, and the minister should say this, and they should make these promises or that promise. It's just not in there. You know, I've got a little black book, like just about all the elders in the church do that tells you what to say. But we, in the modern era of the church, devised a ceremony because it's common in our culture. Emily, I see your hand back there. I'll get to you. Or do you have a question?
Where it said that Isaac was 40 when he
was... it's in chapter 25, verse 20.
Okay.
So it's not in this account, but it's mentioned later that he's 40. And... yeah, because he'll be 40 when he gets married and 60 when they have Esau and Jacob. So the nice round numbers there. So to finish my thought about a wedding ceremony, we could say God invented marriage. We commented on that all the way back early in Genesis, that it's a creation by God, but how exactly to perform it isn't specified. I like the ceremony we have. And it's well done. It quotes scripture and explains what marriage should be. And one of the most important things is we emphasize the understanding that a marriage is not only a covenant between a man and a woman, but we call it a three-way covenant. A man and a woman and God joined together. And so we do that, and that's one of the cases where we do a laying on of hands, a little different than for anointing or ordaining, because we put their right hands together, and the minister lays his hands on their hands and asks God to unite them in marriage. And we do acknowledge that it's God doing it. But having said that, if a couple runs off to the justice of the peace, we still consider them married, because the Bible doesn't say that it has to be done a certain way. But there is indication that there's something done, that it's not just you sleep together and thus you're married. That's just committing fornication. So the Bible doesn't say you're married because of that, but it doesn't say what constitutes a marriage or a wedding. Did I say enough on that? I wanted to emphasize, because it's one of those things when I first realized, I'm in the church all these years and I never knew that. You just sort of take some things for granted. Okay, we'll move on in chapter 25. Actually, there's one other thing I wanted to comment. This whole story with the servant, going and finding a bride and the marriage coming together. I read someone describing how this could be considered an analogy between, or an analogy of the Christian calling. And I kind of like it in that it would show God the Father being in the position of Abraham, having a son that you want to get a bride for. Okay, so Jesus Christ is symbolized by Isaac, and the servant then, they would say, kind of like the Holy Spirit. In this case, the servant goes out and finds a bride and brings her back. The Holy Spirit guides Christians through their life, preparing to marry a groom that they've never met in person. Of course, which would be the marriage of the Lamb to the church when Christ returns. As I said, every analogy has some faults and can break down, but I think this one's kind of cool in a way, so I thought it was worth sharing. Okay, having said that, we're going to move on to chapter 25, which we'll see is going to wrap up the life of Abraham, which is kind of sad because we spend a fair bit of time with Abraham. He's such a significant character. So we'll see, him having a life after Sarah and other sons, but noting that the birthright would still be Isaac's. And so we see here in the first few verses, Abraham again took a wife. Her name was Keturah. We don't talk a lot about Keturah. We don't know much about her. I've read some scholars speculating or even claiming that Abraham probably took Keturah as a second wife while Sarah was still alive, and I think that's kind of silly. I don't think that Abraham would have done it, especially after the problem he had with Hagar and Sarah. Abraham was probably, I want no part of that. But it's worth thinking, Abraham was 137 years old when Sarah died. He would live to be 175. So he's got 38 more years in which he could be married and father these six more children that are mentioned. So six children in 38 years isn't that many. Matter of fact, later we're going to see Jacob is going to have 12 within anywhere from 7 to 14 years. So, of course, he had several women at work in the project, but... so anyways, we have several sons mentioned. They're also listed in another place. In 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 32 is a listing of Abraham's sons by Keturah. The most notable one seems to have been Midian. Midian's mentioned in verse 2. because his descendants would become known as the Midianites. And that's a nation that we see in the story of Israel. Yes, Julie? 1 Chronicles 1, verse 32. And that's just if you want to have that reference. So this isn't the only place we see them mentioned, but we don't see much about them. Partly because, you know, Abraham would send them away. As it says in verse 5, Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. But Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had. And while he was living, he sent them eastward away from Isaac, his son, to the country of the east. So when it says gifts, I'm guessing probably something pretty substantial. Abraham was rich. I mean, really rich. So he could set them up to have a nice life. And he probably didn't do it when they were like 4 years old. I'm sure he waited till they were old enough to be mature and go start a life of their own. But the big main estate or possession is going to be passed to Isaac. Now, it'll seem from what we're going to read that Isaac, because of these gifts and such, maybe what Isaac inherits is less than the peak of Abraham's wealth. Because we'll see God blessing Isaac and him becoming very wealthy as a result of that. Most scholars studying this believe that the descendants of Abraham and Keturah continued living somewhere in the Middle East mostly, although there's some speculation that some of them migrated and lived in what is now Eastern Europe. And again, this is, you know, there's some research that goes into this. It's not just fanciful imagination, but it's not something you can prove with absolute certainty. But as I said, we don't see them a lot in the story aside from the Midianites. Okay, so in verse 7, we're going to reach the end. This is the sum of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived 175. Then Abraham died, or breathed his last, died in a good old age, an old man full of years, and was gathered to his people. None of us look forward to death, but knowing it's going to happen to all of us, this is the way you want it to be. Full of years, with your family around, and, you know, sort of a satisfied ending. It's interesting, we see here in verse 9, and his sons Isaac and Ishmael, doesn't mention any of the sons of Keturah, but Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, which is before Mamre. This is, you know, as it says in verse 10, the field that Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. Okay.
Question about the phrase gathered to his people. What is it referring to? Like,
it's an idiom to mean he died. Yeah, and we might, I'm not sure of what underlying meaning, but it's sort of like later on you'll see slept with his fathers. You'll see that for the kings of Israel. Yes, Dr. Britt?
So I've heard that what they would do is after the body of Jesus was thrown, they would then move the bones of that person
and
be with
one of
the other pile of bones, and that's what they gather
to the body. Yeah, so you get a valid point. We don't know for sure how big that cave was. Although it reminds me of something, one of the most bizarre things I ever saw. This is when I was in grad school. I was just thinking, during the French Revolution, you know, in France, they were starting new on a whole bunch of things, so they emptied a lot of the graveyards. And they had some old, what they called catacombs under the city from old mines and such, so they took all the bones in there and stacked them up just to get them out of the way so they could use the cemeteries over again. And the year that I did a travel study class in France, I think I mentioned we're studying the World Wars, and you know what that instructor, you know, our professor said, "Hey, we could do this catacombs tour and see where they put the bones." No, okay, that sounds interesting. So, you know, we pay the price, and we're down as a class. We go way, way down, and we're walking. We got flashlights, and we're shining. I'm thinking maybe I'll find a bone here or there, and we go through a room and we see this chamber stacked from bone from here to there and back like 15 feet, packed full of bones. I mean, there were more bones than I've ever seen in my life. It was just eerie and bizarre, and we walked through I don't know how many hundreds of feet of that, which doesn't have much to do with this story, but it goes to show, you know, they're still around for a long time, and those are gathered together, absolutely. Yeah, it was kind of weird. You see a row of long bones, and then a row of skulls, and then other bones. They stacked them up kind of organized. Which makes you want me to start talking about Isaac again, right? Thought that I hadn't finished. Isaac and Ishmael together buried him. Last time we saw Ishmael, remember, he and Hagar were going off in the wilderness. And Ishmael, Hagar thought he was going to die from dehydration, and God showed her a well. And then we heard, oh yeah, he prospered and did well. He hasn't come up in the story, but this is showing there must have been some relationship. You know, he knew that Abraham died, and he and Isaac worked together. It doesn't say there's animosity, that they competed to be the one to bury their father. So apparently there's some relationship ongoing with Ishmael. We don't know exactly what or how much. I don't think he was visiting all the time, so much that they didn't even think had ever left. That wouldn't make sense. He's gone, he's living a separate life, but they have a relationship. And he comes there and he participates in burying his father. And I think that's a very good thing. So I think it's worth pointing out and noting that. Let me add one other thing. There's what it says in Hebrews 11, verse 19, talks about Abraham and the other patriarchs traveling together and seeking a homeland, you know, looking to a country. That gives the idea, and some scholars believe, that Abraham lived not only into Isaac being married, but having his children. So many people believe that Abraham was still alive when Jacob and Esau were born, and some speculate even to as long as them being 14 years old. And that's not certain, we don't know for sure, but you know, the Bible tends to tell one of them story, then stop, and then tell the other story, then the other one, without remembering the overlap. So it's kind of cool if Jacob and Esau knew their grandfather Abraham, you know, and would have had some memories of him. And they're probably at this funeral as well, whatever it is that happens. Okay, so verses 12 through 18, it says, this is the genealogy of Ishmael. So that'll be the Toldoth of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian bore. And these are the sons' names, and I'm not going to read their names because I do bad enough with words that aren't hard to pronounce. But this this seems to have been perhaps a separate document that Moses copied as he's putting together the Pentateuch. And it shows God did indeed fulfill his promise to make a great people of Ishmael. You know, and it was promised 12 princes would come from him, and we see that happen. And we believe that the Arabic peoples were descended from Ishmael. And from what I understand, the Arabic peoples believe that as well, at least most of them. So it's not something we believe that's weird and unusual. That's the common belief. Okay, so we deal with that, and then we move on. In verse 20, well, actually starting in verse 19, this is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife. I mentioned that earlier. Now, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, sister of Laban the Syrian. Note that they're called Syrians because of where they live, but they're the same ethnicity as Abraham and Isaac and the other family, but they're in the land that becomes known as Syria. We don't know if they called themselves Syrians or if that's something that was attached to later because of the family living there. But in verse 21... Oh, yeah, I wanted to say a little bit about Isaac as we move on. Just a little, because I wanted to make note that Genesis says less about Isaac than the other patriarchs. Spent a lot of time with Abraham. We're going to spend a lot of time with Jacob. And usually when we say the patriarchs, we mean Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Sometimes the phrase is applied to the 12 sons of Jacob. So you want to look at the context to see who we mean, but typically the patriarchs are those three. Okay, so Isaac is covered, and he's mostly a bridge between Abraham and Jacob. If the Bible doesn't say much about Isaac, it's worth noting it says very little bad about him. He's one of those characters that seems to have had a really good life without a lot of hardship and without doing terrible things to bring hardship on himself. And I think it's worth noting he could serve in some ways as a model for Christians today who don't need a lot of attention. You know, there are some people who want to be up in the limelight and the lead, you know, look at me, you know, and I get to speak. But a lot of people just would rather be back in the back, you know, doing work, helping and serving, but not having a lot of attention. And what we see about Isaac, that's perfectly fine. We need a lot of people like that, more people like that than the ones standing up on stage getting a lot of attention. So I'm just mentioning Isaac is a good role model and an example that can happen and be perfectly fine. Now getting back to what he does do, though, in verse 21, Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. So Rebekah's not having any kids. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah's wife conceived. Now, it doesn't describe here how long that had been, but we know we see from what's described later that they had been married for 19 years without having any children, without getting pregnant. Yes, Kayla?
Do you know why so many women in the Bible couldn't have children?
No, we don't. That's a good question. It seems almost to be a family trait. Andrew was saying a lot of stories where someone goes on to do something really great. I think you started covering Samuel earlier today, and of course Hannah wanted to get pregnant and she couldn't, so God intervenes. Abraham and Sarah wanted children. So yeah, you could wonder, was it a case of there was just some health factor that was preventing it, or did God prevent it to show his power when he did give children? And the answer is, I don't know. It doesn't tell us, and all the guessing in the world won't give us a firm answer. I remember when Sue and I were trying to get pregnant and were studying about it, when you see all the challenges for that one sperm to impregnate the one ova, yeah, egg cell, you know, all the stuff they have to go through, it's amazing anyone ever gets pregnant. It's astounding, and yet it happens all the time. So it's an incredible miracle. Why the case here, we just don't know. One of the points I wanted to make, though, Abraham and Sarah waited 25 years, but remember, 14 years or so into that, they took matters in their own hands. Sarah says, I can't get pregnant. Here's Hagar, take her. Isaac doesn't do that, and Rebekah apparently doesn't suggest it. So they wait a long time. We noted in chapter 25, 20, that Isaac was 40 when they get married. Down in verse 26, it'll tell us he was 60 when the twins are born. That's how we know there was 20 years of them being married with no children. God did hear their prayers. And, you know, of course, one of the reasons Isaac probably, if Rebekah did suggest, hey, I got a servant, Isaac would remember his relationship with Ishmael when they were younger and say, we're not going down that road. I know what happens. So we don't know if it was suggested. I'd like to say that it never was. They were just trusting God. And as it says, he pleaded with the Eternal for his wife because she was barren, and the Eternal granted his plea. Now, something interesting comes up. The children struggle together within her. So, and it says children as though she knows, but all she knows is her belly's big, and man, this is rough. You know, everyone else doesn't seem to have that. So she went to inquire of the Lord. And he did an ultrasound and showed her the picture and said, of course not. It goes to show we have things that make it easy to know what's going on and for us to understand, but she didn't know there were twins, but God told her miraculously. Behold, two nations are in your womb, two peoples. So it's twins, but they're not identical. They're obviously fraternal, and they're going to have very different natures and be the forefathers of nations with different traits. You know, two people will be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Okay, so as we'll see mentioned later in the New Testament, what did they do to deserve one of them being chosen for the blessing and the other not? Answer, not a thing. They weren't even born yet. So God just chose, for whatever the reasons. He might have looked at their genetic structure and decided he could work his plan better through Jacob than through Esau. Or maybe it would be harder. And remember in 1 Corinthians 1, not many wise men now are called. Sometimes I wonder, it's like, no, the Israelites weren't better. We might find out they were worse, but God wanted to show what he could do with the worse. But I'm just saying might, possibly. Maybe they were better, or better in some ways. Interesting in that phrase, the one people shall be stronger than the other. We might presume that that's the same one that's going, that's Jacob. But at least in their physical lives, Esau was stronger than Jacob. But the older did serve the younger. Esau was the older. And by the way, it's usually assumed that the same, it means that the younger is the stronger. I'm just proposing that it could have been the other way around, but God ordained that the younger would receive these blessings. And we go forward. When the days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed, there were twins in her womb. The first came out and he was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau, which means hairy. You know, he's red and hairy. Afterward, his brother came out. His hand took a hold of Esau's heel, so they called him Jacob. Jacob or Jacob, Means, it can be interpreted a couple ways. Literally, it means to grab and trip, like to trip someone to gain advantage over them. But, you know, it could also be interpreted in a broader sense to mean to defraud or to deceive, or you see the term to supplant. Like, I'm going to trip you so I can, like if you're rushing in line for lunch after I'm finally done, and Nate sees Tim come and he trips him so he can go and get whatever goodies there are first. And I know Nate would never do that, but so they name Jacob that when he's still a little baby. All he's done is just reach out and grab Esau's heel. Now we'll see that it, you know, would develop some later. They'll say he deserved that name. And I can't help, you know, poor Esau. It comes out red and hairy all over. It makes it sound like you're going, ugh, but I still remember, this is something my mother told me a number of times, and I don't think she meant it to hurt my feelings, but she said when I was born, I looked like a skinned rabbit. I've never seen a skinned rabbit, but I don't imagine it being that attractive, but nobody said I looked like that much since then. Babies, when they come out, babies look a little funny no matter what, but they quickly develop. Okay, let's move on. I just wanted to share that. Mom would be proud if she were here, I'm sure. Oh, I might make a mention, though, that prophecy in verse 23, you could also make a note to tie that to Romans chapter 9. Romans 9 and verses 13 through 16, the Apostle Paul cites that to as an example that God has the right to do this and that God can give blessings to whom he chooses just because he's God and he's justified in doing that. So that Romans 9, verses 13 through 16. Okay, so we see these traits, and then they grow up. Verse 27, as the boys grew, so the boys grew, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. He liked the hunting outdoor life. Today, he'd have a lot of camouflage in his closet and several rifles, and he'd be the first out for deer season. Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. The Old King James said plain. I believe that word in the Hebrew is ish-tam, which I've seen a lot of people saying it could be translated as an upright man or a blameless man. Others, my margin of my Bible says complete. So you could say he's a normal guy in some ways. He's kind of ordinary. Whereas Esau is out, you know, with a dirt bike and building ramps and killing animals and all that. Jacob's kind of normal and plain. But, and he's law-abiding, but he'll take advantage of others and manipulate them to get what he wants. We'll see that later on. Jacob, we'll see later, has a skill with livestock. He's good at managing the animals, breeding, taking care of them, keeping them alive and healthy. Probably well-suited to whatever mercantile business the family had. And I made a note in that because I've overlooked mentioning it earlier on when Abraham's traveling, that although the Bible just mentions the flocks and herds, we want to remember they're moving around in this area, traveling up and down, and this is a major trade route. Three continents come together here. So they would have a good opportunity to buy and sell and trade and be involved in business of that sort. I'm saying they had opportunity. Scripture doesn't necessarily tell us that they did do so, but I suspect they probably did at least some. And as I said, it seems like that's the kind of thing Jacob would be more interested in than Esau. Esau's out in the field, you know, hunting animals. Okay, I saw some confusion over here. Did I leave something out? Yeah, ish-tam, plain man, or upright man, or complete man. The ish means man, so a man who is tam. Okay, well, yeah, we get the famous story of the birthrights, beginning in verse 29 to the end of the chapter. Jacob cooked a stew. Esau comes in from the field. He's weary, and he says to Jacob, please feed me with that same red stew. I'm weary. And they make the point that later on he's given the nickname of Red, and which was Edom. So he's going to be called Red from then on. And Red's a pretty cool nickname, even in our society. Jacob said, I'm hungry. Boy, can I have some of that food? Jacob, what would have been the right thing for Jacob to do? Give him some food. He's your brother. Instead, Jacob sees an opportunity. says, sell me your birthright. Well, Esau, well, I'm about to die, so what good is the birthright? If I'm dead, I can't have my birthright anyways. So yeah, I'll agree. I sell the birthright. I've got the Hebrew for that as well. If you want to have it, this is not something I'm going to ask you to memorize, but Bechora. What was the birthright? It was a special privilege tied to inheritance based on birth order. Traditionally, the oldest, the firstborn, gets the birthright. And it included two or three things. Okay, so the person with the birthright would, when the previous person died, he would take over leadership of the family or leadership of the clan. Isaac is the leader of the family slash clan. So Esau, with the birthright, would expect to succeed him. When he sells it to Jacob, then Jacob has the right to say, I'm the leader of the family. Okay, number two, and more important financially, is the person with the birthright gets a double portion of the inheritance, twice as much as all the others. So say you have six kids, you divide the inheritance up into seven parts, and one, the firstborn, gets two parts. So you divide it up as though there's an extra one, and you give the first a double portion. So that's a pretty significant, you know, blessing. And number three on my list, and I put in parentheses, sometimes it included a special blessing from the father, which we see a big deal made of coming up pretty soon in this story, a special blessing. But some scholars have said it didn't have to be part of the birthright. You could have your father give a special blessing to the son, or I suppose daughter, that he wanted to. Okay, archaeological records show that in the culture of that time, it was not all that uncommon for a firstborn to sell his birthright. So when I've read this, I've always thought, man, what an unusual, bizarre, crazy thing to do. But they say, no, it did happen. Now, to sell your birthright for a bowl of soup, that's crazy, unusual, and bizarre. So that was unusual. And later on, Esau is called profane for so lightly valuing his birthright. It's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 12, Hebrews 12, verses 16 and 17. And why profane? Remember, profane is something that's not holy. It's common. Well, the birthright in this case was going to include special blessings from God that are holy. Okay, so Esau is not valuing this very much. Is Jacob innocent in this matter? Of course not. You know, Jacob took unfair advantage of his brother. Esau is tired. Maybe he really thinks he's on the verge of death. The right thing would have been to do is give him the food, not try to extort something from him. Now, I think I've got Romans 12, verse 20, mentioning that a Christian should feed an enemy when they're hungry, much less, or much more so, your brother. So yeah, Jacob should have willingly given Esau food out of compassion. He shouldn't have extorted some price, especially not something as great as the birthright for it. But that doesn't change the fact that Jacob did get the birthright. It was a legal transaction. Yes, Sky? Hebrews 12, 16 and 17. Okay, and of course, well, Jacob does go one extra. He not only gives him the bowl of soup, but he gives him some bread. That's the nice extra. This seems like a good place to take a break. And we'll move on. We'll see the continued family drama that's going to go on here that has repercussions still on us today.